there. When he faced me again, he said in a low voice. There were photos of her clothing in one of the books.
What about your intuition?
Asked Lisa in a small voice. She was responsible for bringing me here. His mouth softened. Nicole, I said. She looked at me, and then straightened when she could meet my eyes.
I can't leave, she said.
I nodded. What are you doing?
I can't leave,
she told me sadly, running her hand down his arm. He didn't kill you? I asked. She looked at him bewildered.
I can't leave.
There wasn't a lot of intelligence left. The kind of haunting that Rick had described, brutal and powerful, just seemed beyond her. Rick, I said, still looking at her, did you kill your wife? What do you think? He said bitterly. Do you think she'd haunt me otherwise? The case against me was dismissed, you know, because my money ensured that no one could prove my guilt. Sometimes people learn to lie so well I can't hear it in their voice, especially if they've had years to practice or even come to believe their own lies. But I had to get a yes or no answer even to try. Did you kill your wife, Mr. Albright? I asked again.
I can't leave,
his dead wife said again, and leaned her head against his shoulder.
I can't leave.
He shivered, but I don't think he felt her. Yes, he said coolly. Of course I killed her. He looked at Lisa when she gasped. You have to know it, he said harshly. If I hadn't been filthy rich, I would have rotted in prison for the rest of my life, or sat on death row until someone decided to pull the lever. Werewolves and mercy, Zack said conversationally, can tell when you are lying. What Zack means to say, Lisa, I told her, is that that was a big, fat lie. Not the part about being rich having saved him, but the part about his having murdered his wife. Which leads to the question, why then is she haunting you, Rick? All she can tell me is that she can't leave. Zack stared at me as if I were speaking Greek, but Lisa took a big, shaky breath.
I knew it, she said.
Then she walked over to Rick and shoved him.
That's for trying to make me think you're a murderer, stupid.
Then she turned back to me.
So why can't she leave?
I shrugged. I've run into a few different kinds of ghosts. I used to think there were only three kinds, but I'd expanded my knowledge a bit over the past few years. There are more things in heaven and earth and all that. But some things still held true. One of the most common kinds that I've seen are repeaters. Ghosts that seem to reenact the same events over and over. Traumatic events, said Zack. I nodded. Usually, but sometimes just everyday things, habits. They don't interact with the real world much. The appearance of body parts, that fits with a repeater, except that she didn't die here in the hot tub room, right? And repeaters are usually tied to places, not people.
It's his fault, the ghost said.
No, I told her. He didn't kill you.
It's his fault, she said again. I can't leave.
Is he holding you here? She stared at me.
It's his fault. It's his fault I died.
I don't know if the dead can lie or not. I just didn't think that this ghost had enough personality left to lie. I looked at Rick. How could it be your fault that she died? He shook his head. I don't know. The hair on the back of my neck started to tingle, and my ears popped like I was on an airplane in rapid descent. A sweet scent from my childhood drifted to my nose as well as the sharp scent of ozone, lightning, just before it strikes. I didn't know what it was, but it didn't feel like anything very healthy. And the first rule in my sensei's rules of combat is, run. Everyone out of the house, I said. I followed my own advice and started for the door. I grabbed Lisa's upper arm as I moved. I didn't run, but I wasn't waiting for flies to gather either. Zack took my lead, and as he walked by Rick, he put a hand on his shoulder and pushed him along. Rick didn't struggle so much as hesitate, but Zack was a werewolf, so Rick came with us. So did Rick's dead wife. Even with the ghost tagging along, I felt better with the door closed behind us. which meant whatever was unnerving me, it wasn't Nicole Albright.
Tell me, I said, about the times you saw your wife when you weren't here. When was the first time?
If you'll tell me why I just got hustled out of my own home, Rick said.
Something happened, Lisa said. I don't know what, but a whole marathon of people were jogging across my grave.
Did you feel anything? I asked Zack.
The spike of emotion from you, and a moment later from Lisa, said Zack.
He was kind enough not to say that what he'd smelled was terror.
But I smelled something different. Not sure what it was. Sweet.
Bubblegum, I said.
And Rick's pupils contracted. That means something to you? I said.
My mother.
He half laughed.
She had this shampoo that was supposed to be pomegranate or something. She paid a fortune for it. But to me it always smelled like pink bubblegum.
Tell me, I said, about your mother.
I'm not in the habit of opening my personal box of poor little rich boy stories to everyone who asks, he told me.
I think he meant to sound affronted or cold, because he ended up somewhere in the middle, and I could smell his refusal, his pain.
Lisa put her hand on his and squeezed. He looked at her, and I remembered what he said about intuition. He must know how she felt. Even without intuition, Lisa's face was open and honest.
He turned his hand over until he held Lisa's.
But I've already agreed to this, haven't I? She was a real piece of work, my mother. Psycho of the year who was married to the worst husband of the year. But it's not my mother who is haunting me, it's my wife.
But his dead wife touched his cheek, looked at him with her big sad eyes, and said, It's his fault. It's his fault. I can't leave.
He flinched and let out a gasp, and I couldn't see her anymore.
Did you see something? Asked Lisa.
She was here, he said. Just for a moment.
But you didn't see her. I double-checked with Lisa.
No.
Me neither, Zack said. But I smelled something, just for a second.
His mouth twisted a little, and I knew that whatever he smelled hadn't been pleasant.
Did you hear what she said? I asked Rick.
He shook his head. Beyond that quick gasp, he hadn't reacted at all.
I've heard her say two things over and over, I told him.
It's your fault, he said tiredly. I can't leave.
When I saw the head in the hot tub room, she said, it's his fault, Lisa told me.
That's what she tells me, too, I said. You didn't kill her, so why isn't she haunting whoever did?
Rick looked around as if he'd never been out on his porch before. Then he walked over to the steps and sat down. He patted the stairs beside him, and Lisa joined him.
Zack folded his arms, nodded to them, then turned away. His body language was a promise to stay in the background. He was right. Rick would talk more if I was the only stranger he was talking to. I hopped over the porch railing and walked in front of the stairs. The porch was high, so sitting on the top step as they were put their heads and mine on a level.
First, I said, you know who my husband is. So you know that if I wanted fame and glory, I wouldn't have to use you to get it. I am not about to sell your story to the newspapers or tabloids. Second, Zack and I have very good noses, and for me, scent is sometimes the first indication that there is a ghost in the room. Third, your wife doesn't have the energy it would require to follow you for all these years. If I hadn't known that she was this active, I'd have told you she'd leave in a few months.
I paused and waited. Lisa patted his hand, and he turned his over and grabbed hers hard.
You think my mother is behind this?
I know that there was something else in that room when I pulled us all outside. I know it was not Nicole. It didn't have the same feeling at all. It felt like some weird combination of fey magic. Some fey magics smell like ozone to me. And danger. And Zack and I both smelled bubblegum. You say your mother smelled like bubblegum, and she committed suicide 2 days after your wife died. Even I remember that headline. I paused for effect.
Tell me, Rick, how did she and your mother get along?
Lisa whispered, You think his mother killed his wife, then killed herself?
I don't know anything about his mother, I said.
I've thought about it before, Rick said starkly. She could have done it. My mother was
batshit crazy, said Lisa, and moved until her body leaned against his. She looked at him for permission, and he nodded for her to continue. She pulled Rick out of school when he was 12 because she thought he was associating too much with the wrong kids. He was playing with one of the groundskeeper's kids a few years before that, and she shredded the kid's face with her fingernails. Lisa made a claw out of her free hand. Kid had to have cosmetic surgery, which Rick's dad paid for.
Rick cleared his throat. My mother was 16 when she met my father, and he was 40. Her father had abandoned her and her mother when she was 13. Her mother committed suicide when my mother was 15. She told me that her father's family took care of her. But I can't confirm that because no one, and I mean no one, ever talked to them but her. She was too rich to go into the foster system, so she was left in her home and watched over by a series of caretakers who were hired by trustees and lawyers. He took a breath. My father was handsome, rich, and far older than she was. She was beautiful, rich, and young, and had no one. If my father had been a different man, it might have worked. He really loved her at first, and she adored him. Adored being his wife, and adored being the mother of his child. When she was pregnant with me, she found out he was having an affair. And our home was a battle zone from then on.
He smiled one of those smiles that mostly point out that the person wearing them is not happy, and said, "For most of my life she alternated between being supermom and a crazy woman, sometimes both in the same 10 minutes. So, do I think she could have killed my wife and cut her into pieces?" He looked over my shoulder at nothing, and swallowed.
"Yes, I've always thought so."
He returned his gaze to me.
"She found Nicole for me, introduced us, encouraged me to ask her to marry me. Then, after the wedding, the day my wife was murdered, Mother came to my office with a folder. She showed me proof that my wife had been sleeping with another man throughout our engagement."
He cleared his throat.
"Nicole got a butterfly tattoo on her shoulder blade 2 weeks after we started sleeping together. The photos clearly showed her tattoo."
He grimaced.
"My mother had had Nicole followed. She knew about the affair before Nicole and I married. She chose to show the photos to me that day and told me that it was for my sake, so I would understand that my mother was the only one I could trust."
"Crazy bitch," growled Lisa. "And that night your wife was killed," I said.
"Murdered." Rick corrected me like it was important. "If anyone had known that my mother had showed me that file that afternoon, I wouldn't have walked out of the trial a free man. I was always pretty sure my mother had done it. It had all the marks of one of her frenzied, violent moments. Though as far as I know, she'd never killed anyone before. I could never have convinced anyone she'd done it, not once she was dead. Only my father and I ever saw her at her worst. Most people thought she was this little porcelain doll."
"And Lisa is the only one besides you to have seen your wife's ghost," I observed. Lisa, who was beside herself because of how much she loved him, who had gone into the house and was treated to a gruesome sight. But Rick was still caught up talking about his mother.
"My father said she was a psychic vampire," he said.
I blinked at him. "Hold that thought," I said, and pulled out my phone.
"Mercy?" Samuel answered his wife's cell phone. "You know we're in Ireland, right, and we don't want to be bothered?"
Belated honeymoon. "Yes, sorry, but I really need to talk to your wife," I told him. Ariana was a very old fae. If what I was worried about was possible, she would know. Maybe she'd know what to do with it.
"Life and death?" Samuel sounded resigned.
"Death, anyway," I told him. I would have felt worse, but I knew Samuel. If he and Ariana really hadn't wanted to be disturbed, they wouldn't have had the cell phone on. He handed me over eventually. I explained the situation to Ariana, taking my time so I didn't miss any of the details that might or might not be important. "So," I asked her, "is there any way someone of fae blood could kill themselves and make arrangements to haunt someone for the rest of their lives?" "They would have to have some sort of power source," she said. "You told me that when you walked into the house, both you and Zack noticed a drop in the emotional intensity of the humans."
"Yes."
"There aren't a lot of ways this could work," she said after a moment's thought. The easiest way would be to quench an object in her death.
I'd heard that word before. Like when a weapon is quenched and takes on the personality traits of the person who dies.
Like that, yes, she agreed. But it doesn't have to be a weapon.
She gave me a detailed explanation and several possible solutions. Okay, I said, tucking my phone back into my pocket. There are some Fae who can feed on emotions, literal emotional vampires. Zack and I both felt something odd happen when we walked into the house. Rick was ticked off, and both of you, I pointed at Lisa and Rick, were so hot for each other it was uncomfortable. Rick looked at me, but Lisa sucked in a breath and looked at Rick. I shouldn't have done it, but I just couldn't bear watching them not watch each other anymore. 4 years she'd been in love with him, and he with her if I were any judge. I continued as if I hadn't noticed anything. But all that dropped when you walked through the doorway. It didn't seem important at the time. Death magic is not something that the Fae are much involved in. That's a witch thing. But there are some magics that the Fae can use to tie the essence of a person to objects. They used to use it to power their blades or some of their magical items. The essence or spirit was different from a soul. A person's soul, except for thankfully rare instances, was mostly beyond the touch of magic. Your mother, if she learned magic from her father's family, might have learned how to do that, or maybe she contacted someone and asked. My expert friend says that usually the personality fades from such objects. But if your mother could feed herself on your emotions, then she could keep her personality intact indefinitely.
You think my mother killed my wife, then decided that she'd kill herself so she could follow me around and, what, take care of me?
Run off anyone who might compete with her for your affections, I told him. Or maybe just anyone who might harm you. You don't really seem like a hermit at heart, but here you are living isolated from everyone.
Because any time I went out, any time I brought anyone home, my wife would make an appearance, he said. I thought I was going mad. I worried someone would notice.
He looked at Lisa.
You don't know. It was horrible for you, I know. But you don't know what it meant that someone else saw it.
She leaned over and kissed him, which was lovely and sweet. A second later, the window in one of the upstairs rooms blew out and poured glass all over them. I leaned forward to help, but Zack tackled me around the middle and ran 50 feet before he put me down. I stepped back from him and opened my mouth.
I am your bodyguard, he told me almost angrily. You are still limping, and you almost died. I am doing my job.
Okay, I said. The one thing you didn't want to do to a submissive wolf that you cared about at all was put him in the middle of contradictory orders. Adam had told him he was to guard me. I wouldn't yell at him for it like I would have any other wolf. Probably one of the reasons Zack had been my bodyguard a lot lately. Rick and Lisa joined us. Rick had a good-sized wound on his hand, and they both had a few cuts that looked nasty. They'd be feeling them for a few days, but they'd survive. If a big chunk of glass falling from the second story had caught one of them wrong, it could have killed them. Ghosts are seldom truly dangerous. The key word is seldom. If I told you that I think your mother killed herself in a ritual that would put her essence in some object and is from that object influencing your wife's ghost, tried to scare Lisa away because Lisa loves you and your mother wants to keep you to herself, what object comes immediately to mind? I asked Rick. He looked at me.
That one, I said. The one that puts that look in your eyes. But it wasn't hers, he said.
What wasn't hers?
A jade pendant. My father died in a car accident right before I was acquitted. He drove off a cliff with his latest girlfriend. She was 17. When I was going through the bag the morgue gave me, I found it. I don't ever remember seeing him wear it, but I liked it, so I kept it.
He reached up, then looked puzzled.
I still wear it most days.
Not when you come outside to work with me, said Lisa positively. I've never seen you wear any jewelry. His face went slack with realization.
This is going to sound weird.
He looked back at the house where the curtains were fluttering through the broken window.
Okay, not as weird as today has been, but weird enough.
I didn't want to wear it around you, Lisa. It never felt right. I haven't worn it since you came inside the house, and I always wear it.
Love, observed Zack quietly, is a good antidote to a lot of foul magic. Leastwise, that has been my experience.
So, Lisa asked, her naked face turned to Rick, what do we do next?
I walked over to my van and popped open the back hatch. Inside, I found a nice steel pry bar. I find the pendant and break it, according to my expert friend.
What she said, Zack reminded me because he'd overheard both sides of the call, was that breaking it usually stopped the problem, but that there could be a backlash when the item broke.
Where is it? I asked Rick, ignoring Zack for the moment.
In my bedroom.
He glanced up at the broken window.
Up there.
I talked Rick and Lisa into staying outside. Rick wasn't happy about it, but conceded that unless he did, Lisa wasn't going to stay outside, and Lisa, I thought, was the one in real danger. Zack and I, pry bar in hand, walked back in the front door, and nothing happened. No weird effects, no weird sounds, no dead women, nothing. By the time we walked up the stairs, everything felt pretty anticlimactic. I was basing my whole plan of attack on the smell of bubblegum and ozone, and the intuition of a fae-gifted man who thought his mother had killed his wife. Zack made me let him walk into the room first. When nothing happened, I followed him in. The room was huge, with a walk-in closet beside the door and a bathroom on the far wall. A king-sized four-poster bed dominated the room in dark splendor. Beside it, the nightstand held nothing but an alarm clock that was blinking 12.
It was supposed to be on the nightstand, right? Zack asked.
And all hell broke loose. Are you okay? I asked Zack as I crouched beneath a library table along one wall. It was one of the few pieces of furniture that hadn't started attacking us. Zack had grabbed a silver tea tray and was using it as a shield and baseball bat. It beat my table because it was metal and more solid, and he could move without losing his protection. The corner of a drawer managed to hit him in the shoulder pretty good, despite his mad tray-wielding skills.
Tired of this, he said, shaking out his shoulder. Finding anything in this mess is going to take an act of God.
Abruptly, the flurry of thrown objects subsided. I rolled out from under the table, and Zack walked in front of me, tray at the ready.
I've got an idea, I said thoughtfully. Let's walk around the room and see what happens.
I have a better idea, Zack said. We both go outside. Call Elisaveta and set her on this problem.
I shook my head. I don't want to owe the witch any favors. She worried me, truth be told. Witches aren't my favorite people to deal with, and Elisaveta raised my hackles.
She is being paid, Zack pointed out.
For pack matters. This has nothing to do with the pack, I told him. If this doesn't work, we'll rethink.
All right, he said reluctantly. Shall we try near the bed first?
He took two steps toward the bed, and a paperweight flew at him. He caught it, and I got hit by a candlestick I hadn't seen coming because I was watching Zack. It hit me in the ribs with brutal force. Luckily, Zack was distracted and hadn't seen it fly at me. I grabbed it as it fell and held it casually in the hand that wasn't holding the pry bar, as if I'd just picked it up so I would have a weapon in both hands. I tried not to make a sound, because if Zack knew I was hurt, he'd grab me and take me outside to wait with the other two, and I had a strong feeling that I was going to have to be the one who confronted the dead woman. One thing that shape-shifting into a coyote had taught me was that I should listen to my instincts, even if common sense said that Zack was better suited to take on a poltergeist and find the amulet. I gripped my pry bar more tightly, tried to breathe in shallow breaths, and watched the pattern of activity. As soon as Zack neared the bed, overturned with a mattress on the far side of the room, more things flew into the air. Smaller items this time, more paperweights. Someone evidently had a collection of the damned things. Faces, figurines, but they were thrown hard and, as we approached the bed, with increased fury. Zack ducked and danced like a professional dodgeball player, and so did I. She couldn't keep this up for much longer. Ghosts have limits. I have spent a long time learning martial arts. If you spar too much and don't actually fight, you get to the point where you attack with no intention of hitting anything. Every piece that came at us was intended to do damage. I could almost smell the desperate anger of each missile. Except for one. The little wooden box would have missed Zack's head even if he hadn't ducked. I watched it fly across the room and land in the open closet and roll under a shirt lying on the floor. The closet was between me and the door we'd come in from. I moved, and a shoe hit my side just where the candlestick had, and this time I let out a pained yelp.
"Mercy," growled Zack, as I had known he would. "I can handle this. Please, please go. If Adam were here, he'd make you go."
"Fine," I said, pressing my free arm against my ribs. I didn't even have to act like it hurt, because it really did. "Fine. You know what you're looking for, right?"
"I was there when he told both of us," Zack said dryly.
"Okay." I stumbled to my feet and tripped over some of the stuff on the floor. The movement hurt, a lot, but it also put me next to the closet. I used the pry bar to balance myself, feeling the ache in my just-healed left knee because I'd strained it when I fell. I turned as if to say one more thing to Zack and used the motion to hit the box as hard as I could with the pry bar. It shattered on impact. I had a momentary glimpse of a greenish stone, and I aimed my second strike at it. The steel, not as good as cold iron for dealing with the Fae, but not a bad second choice, hit the pendant full force and turned it into jade shards.
"What the—"
The barrage of things that had been in the air stopped, a brush dropping straight to the ground, though it had been on a quick trajectory for the middle of his back. He looked at me and saw the broken box under my pry bar.
"You lied," he said, astonished.
"Nope," I told him. "I don't lie to werewolves. It's too much trouble. I had every intention of going out with the others, though I think I'm going to need a hand to get there. I just thought I'd destroy the pendant before I did." He shook his head.
"I am glad you aren't mine. You're going to be dead before you're 40.
"No,"
rumbled my husband's soft, deep voice from the hallway. I could always tell when he was really mad. It was when his voice got really quiet.
"I'm going to be dead before she's 40.
He stuck his head through the doorway and took in the mess. He frowned at me.
"There I was talking to five cops at the same time when Samuel called me from Ireland and told me that Ariana said you were about to get yourself killed. I might have a speeding ticket waiting for me when I get home, if they don't show up here."
I'd made Adam break the speed limit. Adam always drove the speed limit. I tried to look like breathing didn't hurt. A big drop of blood from my forehead hit the carpet. It was probably a good thing the carpet was dark brown. "I'm not dead yet." He closed his eyes and sagged against the doorframe. Since he couldn't see me with his eyes closed, I figured I was safe limping over to him. But he lifted an arm for me to duck under as soon as I got near. So trying to hide how badly I was hurt was probably a lost cause.
"Are you finished here?"
he asked.
"Yes," Zack said.
"No," I told them. "I don't think so."
"Okay."
Adam nodded at Zack. To me, he said,
"Do we need to wait here, or is it okay to head downstairs?"
Before I answered, there were sounds on the stairs.
"She said wait outside," said Lisa.
"My house, my ghost," Rick answered. "And it sounds like the worst is over one way or another, anyway."
He walked through the doorway, Lisa trailing after him. She gave me an apologetic look.
"He's not used to following orders."
"No," Rick said, "he isn't. He also doesn't like being talked about in the third person."
He took a good look at his bedroom and quit teasing Lisa.
"Holy Roman Empire. What happened to my bedroom?"
He paused, glanced around a little mournfully.
"I liked that Tiffany lamp."
Guiltily, I shook my hair, and a few more fragments of colored glass fell on the floor. Zack had had time to mend, so the dark red spots on his naked chest that would have been bruises on someone else had faded to normal.
"Your mama," said Zack apologetically, "didn't want us to smash that necklace."
He paused, and his nostrils flared. I smelled it too, ozone and bubblegum.
"Mercy?"
asked Adam, his body stiffening next to mine. I thought it was too easy, I told them. The pendant was a focus, but ghosts don't just... I paused as a woman took form in the center of the room. Ghosts don't just appear at nighttime, but they are scarier then, and maybe easier for people to believe in. Can anyone else see her? I asked quietly. Adam shook his head, and so did everyone else. Rick, I asked, what's your mother's full name? I don't know that it mattered, but the Fae thought it did, and I know that pack magic rides on identity. New pack members come in with their full names for the pack to recognize. As my brother Gary said, most of the Indian tribes don't speak the name of the dead for fear that they'll attract their attention or make them linger. Gina, he said. Gina Stephanie Albright. Is she here? She's tiny, I told him. I could see where Rick got his lack of height. Dark hair, blue eyes. She was staring at me. That's her. She threw the knife so fast that if I hadn't been half expecting something, and if I hadn't been a fair bit faster than human, she'd have hit Lisa with it. As it was, I knocked it out of the air and stepped in front of Lisa. Adam followed my lead, and the other two men closed the holes until we had Lisa walled off. Gina, I said, it's time to sleep now. She shook her head, looking at me with wide, innocent eyes. That tramp. I thought he was safe. But that tramp, she has to die. You saw how she looks at my boy. She wants him, but she'll only hurt him. He's too unworldly. He doesn't know that she's a whore at heart, you'll see. Gina. It's my job, she screamed at me. The violence of her anger was sudden, like a flipped switch. My child, I protect him and he won't leave. She frowned at him. And as quickly as it had come, the rage was gone, and she was just sad. They always leave. Mama says that men are weak, and women are whores. She looked at me with sudden intensity, and I became aware that Rick's shoulder brushed mine. Whore. Gina Stephanie Albright, I told her. It's time for you to stop. She was spirit without soul, so there would be no moving on for her. And I never lied to something that might know I was lying. She made no motion, but a pottery vase flung itself at my head. I knocked it away with the pry bar, took a deep breath, and pulled on my mate tie to Adam, borrowing the absolute authority that he bore innately, and also that part of me that was Coyote, the part that allowed me to see ghosts when no one else could. Gina Stephanie Albright, I told her, filling my words with truth and command. You have no power. You have no place. You will not hurt anyone ever again. You do not belong here. Go away. Her face twisted in rage, and I could feel her push at the commands I had given her. But I could also feel the fade in the energy of whatever force it was that allowed her ghost to remain. Whore, she screamed at me. Whore! Go, I told her. And she was gone. So, I told Adam as we drove home together, Zack had volunteered to take my van home, I think that there's no point in rebuilding the garage. I told Rick and Lisa that I was pretty sure that the one ghost was gone and that the other would fade with a little time. I also told them that if they or the neighbors had any further trouble, they were welcome to call me. I had the distinct impression that they was the right pronoun, and Lisa wasn't going to be going to her home any time in the near future.
You don't want to rebuild the garage.
Adam's voice was very neutral, a statement, not a question. I mean, I said, trying to sound casual about it, businesslike, it's not exactly a high-profit career, fixing cheap cars so they'll run another year. It will cost a lot to rebuild, more than the business could earn in years. I've already sent in the call to have it leveled to the ground. I didn't need to be independent. I trusted Adam, and I could find other ways to be useful. If I decided I needed to earn my own money, I could find a job at Jiffy Lube and make more than I did at my garage.
Call came to the house phone while we were gone, he said.
Jesse left a voice message on my phone a few hours ago. The new body and paint guy, Lee, says that he told you the Karmann Ghia you put the Porsche engine into was going to be a hit. He was quite clear that he thought you should have trusted him. Lee had taken the Karmann to a concourse in Southern California.
It apparently brought in twice the estimate at the auction, about $19,000.
Adam glanced at me, then away, the corner of his lip turning up.
Jesse told me to tell you that she is sure about the $19,000, and yes, she asked him twice. Apparently the guy who lost the auction is sending you a good body to fix for him if you can do all the work for $12,000, which Lee has already assured him you and he could do. He's bringing back two other commissions as well, so you should, I quote Jesse, who quoted him, get your ass in gear and find somewhere to work, unquote.
$19,000 meant about $10,000 profit split between me, Kim the upholstery guy, and Lee, the new body and paint man, for work that had taken me about 40 hours altogether. Not doctor's wages, but not bad either. I said a quiet prayer of thanks, not for the first time, that the Karmann had been getting painted and hadn't been stuck in my garage when the disaster struck.
So, Adam continued, I took the liberty of telling our contractor to be ready to rebuild, and in the meantime you can work out of the pole barn. I'll loan you the amount the insurance doesn't cover.
With interest, I demanded. He pursed his lips and said,
of course. That makes sense. Charging my wife interest. What a smart idea.
I said, and he grinned at me. He turned his head back to the road, but pulled my hand to his lips and bit one of my knuckles with playful promise.
Besides, as long as forgotten deities, vampires, and kids with grudges stay away, mechanicking is a much safer occupation than ghost hunting. I'm all about keeping you safe.
Outtake from Silverborn. This is an outtake. A scene that I knew happened between the 14th and 15th chapters of Silverborn while all the people who care about Mercy are out looking for her. I had no good way to fit this into the book, given that Silverborn is told strictly from Mercy's viewpoint. I didn't intend to ever write it down. It is not a story, really, just a scene. But my husband, after reading Silver, told me that I needed to remind readers that there was a happy ending to Samuel and Ariana's story, even if it was a long time later. So for those of you who have not read Silverborn, there are some spoilers in here. Ariana. Somewhere between Walla Walla and the Tri-Cities in Washington State. The snow had fallen overnight. Ariana pulled into a meadow that had turned into a parking lot. Two of the cars like hers were bare, but a big black SUV and a cherry red Mercedes were dusted with snow. Adam and Samuel had been here all night. Samuel was beside himself, and Adam, she couldn't think about Adam for very long without pulling her beast from its rest. Adam was very, very scary. Z said he wasn't usually like this, that Adam was usually cool and controlled. But he'd been wounded and asleep when his mate went into a Fairy Queen's Elfame to rescue a human boy. The boy and the rest of the rescue party had gotten out, but Mercy had stayed behind. Shortly thereafter, someone had broken the mate bond that held Adam to his mate, and though she had tried, Ariana hadn't been able to use Adam or anything else of Mercy's to find the Elfame. Mercy's ties to the pack, to her real life, had been sundered. Ariana locked her car, pulled on her gloves, and began to walk a different direction than she had yesterday and the day before. She let her earth magic seep into the soil, reaching out to look for something that didn't belong. Z had been here before her. She could feel the touch of the iron-kissed Fae on the land. If he hadn't found the Fairy Queen's lair, then the chances of her doing so were slim. But still, she had to look. It was Ariana's fault, after all. If she'd been stronger, braver, more something, then Mercy would have been freed with the rest of them. They had been looking for her now to no avail for 2 weeks. If she had thought about it very long,
Ariana would have given the Silver Born to the Fairy Queen right from the start. It was an artifact of power. But owning it was more curse than blessing, because it drained the powers of any fae who happened to get too close. They always thought there was some secret magic, some spell she'd put on it to allow her to siphon off the magic. There wasn't. But fae don't give up advantage easily, so it made them unwilling to believe any other fae would do so either. She was paying too much attention to her dowsing and not enough attention to where she was going. She stepped around a half-downed fence and found herself face-to-face with a pair of werewolves. She'd known they were out here somewhere. Hadn't she just noticed their cars? But she knew that they had been told about her, told to avoid her, and she hadn't seen any sign of them except for their cars since she'd started searching. She froze, unable to move, unable to do anything about the black entity that crawled up her spine and took over her body. Magic coiled in her hands, and the beast who rode her waited for them to attack. A gloved hand covered her eyes. Another wrapped itself around her, pinning her arms to her sides. But before panic took her entirely, a voice said, Samuel's voice said, "Run away. Get out of here now." His body was so warm along her back. Familiar warmth, though it had been a very long time since she had last felt it. She could smell the scent of his skin, but she could also feel the beast's magic waiting eagerly for the beast to direct it. Frantically, she reminded the beast who Samuel was and that he wouldn't hurt them. The beast relaxed against Samuel, mesmerized by the sound of his breath, and it slept. Ariana sucked in a deep breath of air.
"Stupid," she told him harshly. "That was so stupid. What were you thinking? It could have killed you, and I wouldn't have been able to stop it."
He left his hand over her eyes and put his lips against her ear. His breath was hot as he spoke.
"That's my job, Ariana. The beast that lives inside of you is not so different from the one who lives inside of me. It knows when it meets a more dominant predator. It knows that I would never hurt you or allow you to be hurt."
"It's a beast," she hissed. "It knows nothing."
"It knows me," he told her soothingly.
His lips brushed her ear as his arms eased from around her. Maybe it had been an accident, that touch of lips. He stepped back from her, touched his finger to his forehead, and walked off. Several times in the days to follow, she caught glimpses of him. She was sure it was deliberate. Sometimes he was in human skin. But twice he was the great white wolf she'd only seen 3 times before. Once when he'd attacked her, once on the day he'd left, and once when he'd come back and killed her father's hounds. Centuries ago, but she knew him. Huge and white and dangerous, he stalked a parallel path to hers, pretending he wasn't watching her. It made her smile. Snow fell and temperatures plummeted, and still they searched. The only wolf she saw was Samuel, but she heard their mournful cries on the wind as she patiently walked a new route. She smelled the coffee before she saw him, waiting for her next to a 3-sided animal shelter. He gave her a foam cup of strong, dark coffee, still uncomfortably hot.
"Samuel," she said.
He looked tired and gaunt. She wondered where he was staying. He'd lived, she thought, in the house that had burned down.
"Adam doesn't think this is working," he said with a nod to the open field. "My Da is flying up tomorrow."
"Your Da?" she said. "I thought he died."
Samuel shook his head.
"No, not exactly, though it took me a long time to find him and bring him home."
She was curious, but didn't want to bring up bad memories. She took a sip to stop her mouth, then thought of something. She frowned.
"Bran, right? Your Da's name was Bran. Samuel Cornick, Bran's son. Bran Cornick, the Maroc?"
He smiled.
"That's the one. He's an old dog and has some canny tricks. We're hoping he can contact her when the rest of the pack has failed."
He must have seen her doubt.
"My Da is a werewolf, but his ma was a witch, and witch blood generally breeds true."
They stood there for a while, sipping coffee in the lee of the old animal shelter.
"How did you know when my father's hounds came for me?" she asked. "I would have called you, but I had no magic to do it with. The beast inside of me could have called you by burning your hair, but it didn't, because I still have it."
"Do you?"
he asked, his cup arrested only half-lifted to his mouth. She felt the corner of her lips turn up, despite herself.
"Yes. I saw them come, and the beast rose up, leaving me with only scattered memories."
Her momentary happiness retreated in the face of the past.
"I remember his hounds beating at the door of my home as we cowered, my terrorized beast and I. Then the howls of a wolf. I saw you, a brief glimpse of you that the beast tried to hide from me. You were standing bloodied and triumphant, my father's hounds dead at your feet. And then I have nothing until days later. The beast destroyed anything you'd left behind and tried to take my memories of you. I only found them later."
"She was only trying to protect you, your beast," Samuel said. "You shouldn't be so harsh to her."
"How did you know?"
Samuel looked away.
"My wolf thought you were our mate," he said. "I didn't know it then, but
he forged ties of wolf magic between us. You would have had to accept them before the ties became permanent, but until you rejected us, they bound me to you. I felt your terror, and it took me 3 days to find you. When I had killed the hounds, she opened the door, a woman with your face and black eyes, terrified of the hounds and of me. She asked me to go and never come back, and her words broke our bond."
His voice was bleak.
He took a deep breath and turned back to her with a ready smile that didn't touch his eyes.
"But that was a long time ago, and she had reason to fear me, didn't she? I'd made her kill someone she loved."
They drifted back into silence. She didn't know what he thought about, but she considered the compassion he had for the beast who had nearly destroyed them both when it had killed Haida. The events had been, as Samuel had said, a long time ago. But she had let her fears, born back in the past, endanger a woman who did not deserve it.
"The wind has picked up," Samuel told her reluctantly. "We'd better go."
She shivered, looked at his tired face, and said, "Come home with me tonight. Let me feed you."
He frowned at her.
"I don't need to be taken care of, Ariana."
"Don't you?"
She smiled into her coffee.
"Don't we all? Come home with me. We can pretend we are wise old things while we eat. In the night, we can hold each other and believe that your Da can fix my mistake."
He dropped his cup on the ground and rounded on her so quickly she dropped hers, too. He was faster than she remembered, and fiercer as he growled,
"This is not your fault."
"Is it not?" she asked. "I made the Silver Born. I failed the contest that would have let us all free."
"Your strength saved all of us except for Mercy," he said. "I salute your bravery."
"My failure," she spit, suddenly angry. "You cannot put me on a pedestal of memory. I am not perfect, not strong, not beautiful."
She dropped the glamour that made her look human, let the clothes fall away so he could see her as she really was. He took off his coat and wrapped her in its warmth. He squeezed her shoulders, then took a few steps away and gave her his back.
"I tried to kill myself a few weeks ago, Ariana. Time. So much time. Centuries and centuries of time. And nothing that mattered to me. No one to whom I mattered. So many people I have loved, and most of them are dead. I have been struggling for decades to rid myself of this malaise of time. And I gave up. If it had not been for the wolf who lives inside of me, I would not have known that had I only held out for a few days more."
He turned to look at her.
"I would have missed you. And I have waited for so long, Ariana. I looked and looked. Then I went on with my life, all the while knowing that you were missing from it."
"You don't know me," she said roughly,
her throat closed at the thought that he might have been gone.
"No," he said with simple honesty. "And yet I have loved you forever."
Tears welled in her eyes when she would have sworn that nothing could bring her to cry.
"And you are brave and stalwart," he said. "I will challenge any who say differently. For you still care, still love, and fear has no hold on your heart."
He kissed her hand.
"I see you now with the experience of centuries, not the clouded eye of a chained prisoner. And my eyes tell me exactly what they told me before. You bring hope into my life when I thought there was none to find."
She reached out her hand, and he took it. "So," she cleared her throat, "that's a yes to dinner then?"
Outtake from Night Broken. This is the second outtake, and it comes from Night Broken. Just after writing the very last scenes of Night Broken, I dreamed this scene. When I woke up, I tried to see if there was any way I could work it into the end. Frostburned had had a whole chapter from Adam's point of view, after all, but it was too short to be a full chapter. Even if it had been longer, and if I'd put a chapter from his viewpoint at the end, I'd have had to do the same thing at the beginning, or the book would have felt unbalanced to me. And there was no reason for Adam to have a chapter at the beginning, so reluctantly I tabled this scene. When my husband asked for a happy scene for Samuel and Ariana in this book, I decided that meant there was room for another outtake, too. This bit comes at the very end of the book, so be aware that there are spoilers for Night Broken herein. Kennewick General Hospital. He joked with her, flirted a little, and teased. And when he could bear it no more, he excused himself to go down and get some food. She had been dying. It was supposed to have been him. He walked down the hospital halls toward the cafeteria, seeing and hearing nothing. Samuel had showed him the X-rays. Her neck had been broken. Nothing they could do. If she lived, she might be able to move her head a little. But she would not live through the night. Samuel loved Mercy, too. But he'd ushered all the others out of Mercy's room and left Adam to his death watch. Adam had been prepared for her death. He'd kept his cool, mostly. When Coyote had come and curled up on the foot of her bed, he thought the old trickster was keeping watch, too. Samuel came back the next morning, and they'd taken new X-rays, because Mercy was wiggling her toes. Adam stopped and realized he'd made it all the way to the cafeteria. It was evening, near dinner time, and there was a short line. Someone bumped into him. Adam looked around and saw a Native American man with a familiar face. He wore a sky blue tracksuit and had one of those pink frilly things girls use instead of rubber bands wound around the end of his braid. There was a little lamb on a chain suspended from the frilly thing. "Here," said Coyote, handing him a white paper bag that smelled of peppers, tomatoes, and sour cream. "Take this. It is better than what they are serving today." Adam took the bag, glanced in it, and said, "I'm going to get a couple of drinks, too. Do you want something?" "Anything but orange juice," Coyote said. "Mercy doesn't like orange juice either," Adam told him. He paid for 3 cranberry apple juices and handed one to Coyote. "Mercy is a smart cookie," Coyote told him, "except when she is not. She acts from her heart, and that leads her to danger. She needs a brave man to run with her. Are you such a man, Adam Hauptmann?" Shrewd eyes stared up into his, and Adam felt his wolf rise to answer the challenge. Instead, Adam opened his juice and drank it all.
"I don't like it when she's hurt, and she would have died if it hadn't been for you."
Coyote looked down modestly, then said, "She was doing my job when she was hurt, so I could help her live if she wanted to. I am an old, old coyote, Adam Hauptmann, and the thought of challenging such a one?" He gave an exaggerated shiver. "No, no, battles are for the young."
He opened his bottle and drank a sip, grimacing at the taste.
"Too much corn syrup," he said. "Don't they know it will stunt my growth? Where was I? Ah, yes. She almost died. That's what life's all about, you know. Death. Everyone dies."
"Except you," Adam felt obliged to point out.
He put a firm lid on his growing irritation at the pontificating. Coyote had saved Mercy. If he wanted to lecture Adam, Adam would listen all day.
Me?
Coyote eyed the bottle with little favor, but took another drink anyway.
I die all the time. Mercy only gets this once. So I ask you again, are you brave enough?
Adam drew a breath, turned away to toss his bottle in the recycling bin, and Coyote was gone.
Stupid Coyote, he said to the air. Brave or cowardly, it doesn't matter. Don't you know that if it is a choice between having Mercy or giving her up, I will be whatever I have to be?
He took Mercy's juice and the white bag of takeout Mexican and walked briskly back to Mercy's room. He opened the door and drew in a breath. Mercy stood silhouetted in front of the window that let in the brilliant light of the setting sun. The red and orange rays lit up her hair, giving it rich red highlights and turning her skin to caramel. He could see the muscles in her arms and legs that were more defined than they had been a few months ago, now that he insisted she upgrade her self-defense techniques. She looked for a moment like a pagan warrior goddess, a goddess clad in one of those ridiculous open-back hospital gowns with some silly bunny and duck pattern running in vertical lines from hem to shoulder. She looked over at him.
"Do I smell jalapenos?" she asked, and she overbalanced.
The wheeled tripod that held her saline drip bag started to tip. He dropped the bag, kept the bottle, and caught her and everything else before disaster happened.
"Hey, handsome," she said in a smoky voice that told him she was still pretty stoned from the pain medications. "Where have you been all my life?"
"Right here," he said, "waiting for you."
"That's a good line," she told him, "but you stole it from a song, so it doesn't count."
"And, hey, handsome, where have you been all my life?" is original.
Something hard dug into his foot, and he looked down to see the silver end of the walking stick on the toe of his boot. The walking stick hadn't been there when he'd left. She saw his interest.
"Look at what showed up late to the party," she said, moving the stick up and waving it around.
He ducked, caught her hand, and collected the walking stick in the hand that held the bottle. He picked her up, hauled her and her equipment over to the bed, and sat her down. It took a few minutes to untangle blankets, sheets, and various tubes that ended in Mercy's skin attached by needles, but eventually he settled her in. By the time he finished, though, she was asleep, the walking stick lying protectively at her side. He kissed her lips, smiling as she grumbled. Then he ate a burrito in the light of the setting sun and watched over his warrior mate. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Shifting Shadows, Stories from the World of Mercy Thompson by Patricia Briggs. Copyright 2014 by Hurog, Inc. Performed by Lorelei King and Alexander Sendiz. Directed by Ali Muradin. Performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. Fairy Gifts, copyright 2011 by Patricia Briggs. Gray, copyright 2011 by Hurog, Inc. Seeing Eye, copyright 2009 by Patricia Briggs. Alpha and Omega, copyright 2007 by Hurog, Inc. The Star of David, copyright 2008 by Hurog, Inc. In Red with Pearls, copyright 2011 by Hurog, Inc. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.